This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
To Simon and the Good Doctor, this is Philip Gallagher from Derry, but living in Dublin. You will be delighted to hear that the term commodian was recently mentioned in the Northern Ireland Assembly. During private members' business, DUP politician Simon Hamilton suggested that the law of cinema is that sequels are always worse, with the notable exception of The Godfather Part 2.
Or Toy Story.
He didn't say that. He was using the quote in reference to a second report recently released on the Northern Ireland economy. Later, he stated that he would not go into, quote, some sort of commodian rant about movies. I'm not sure how many other politicians in the Assembly understood the term, but it shows that the Good Doctor's influence is affecting economic policy consultation in the North. There you go.
And I've been handed something which appears to be a news story verifying that this did actually happen. Private members' business report. Barney 2 does not buck the trend.
Try to sound a little bit interested.
No, I am interested. I am very, very interested. I thought when you started saying that, I thought you were going to say, because I was doing the thing about Mary Poppins in... Belfast over the weekend. I thought this was going in a Poppins kind of way.
No, it turned
into a political thing.
It's becoming a word.
Now, where do we stand there? Because your man there came in from the was it the OED? Was it the Oxford English
Dictionary?
And he was saying that, you know, he was about how many times a word has to be used in a public place in order for the OED to. And there was a brief lived. I think it was one afternoon when you encouraged people to say the word commodian. Well,
if it's been mentioned in the Northern Ireland Assembly, it's been recorded in official business, therefore
it's a word.
It kind of is a word.
It is a word.
Meaning a mad rant based on crazy opinion which might not be true.
Exactly.
That's the definition.
And Stephen Fry has now invented that word cameo.
Yeah, this is because there is an advent calendar which is online, where you go through and you click on whatever day it is that you want to go and have a look at, and there's a little rant behind each door leading up to the 25th of
or
December.
Or in some cases, a very well-considered and thought-provoking discussion.
Well, not many of those. But anyway, it's Stephen Fry on his Twitter thing. Loves the advent calendar. So if it's good enough for Stephen,
yes.
Hello to you, Sir Stephen. It's good enough for most people. There are some emails from people saying they're having difficulty getting it working, but we checked before we came on. It's working perfectly well.
Well, put it this way. I could make it work from Hampshire, and believe me, if it works in Hampshire, it works everywhere else. In Hertford, Hereford and Hampshire, the internet hardly ever happens.
In general, distance from the central computer is not relevant, really.
It is where I live.
Yeah. Dear Morrissey and Marr, says Ian in Oxford, to add to the Good Doctor's reliable rules about films advertised on buses and phone boxes being rubbish, my 15-year-old son has pointed out that films whose titles and publicity material that use that hideous ultra-bold font, nearly always in red, are also rubbish. See random examples below, and he's printed out Fred Claus and How to Lose Friends and Alien. There's a particular bold red font.
Can I also say that there's a particular distributor who uses that particular font?
Yes.
No, it's just it's interesting that sometimes you can actually tell who a film is distributed by the nature of the font which is used.
Well, Ian says, could this simply be studios using big, bold letters to make it easier for the target audience to slowly run their fingers along the words, mouthing letter sounds as they go to work out the title? Or, on the upside, could it be a helpful hidden code allowing more discerning filmgoers to easily avoid inferior fare? Dear Wallace and Gromit, says Jamie Law.
Oh, you know, I was with Nick Park the other day. It was his 50th birthday. I wasn't with him for his birthday. I was with him...
Were you with him or weren't you with him?
No, I wasn't with him. In fact, I'm doing a weird thing, I've been with him, but it hasn't been broadcast yet. It's going out tonight.
Right, so tonight you can see...
Nick Park on the Culture Show Uncut, and he gets a birthday cake.
Jamie Law, currently resident in the Isle of Man, BA Honours, MA, PGCE. If you still want this stuff, he says...
Yes, I do. We do. We demand
it. Well done, Jason Isaacs, says Jamie. At last, someone has outed Simon's film... Philistinism. This is entirely inappropriate. This is because Jason. Just
entirely
because
appropriate.
I feel moved to, when you pick some arty nonsense for your film of the week, to say, let's have a film for ordinary people. And Isaacs has interpreted this as me not liking films with subtitles, which is entirely erroneous. And if he carries on peddling that kind of nonsense, there will be implications. A distinct lack of interest in independent foreign language films. Perhaps Simon could make up for this by saying hello on a regular basis to Michael Fassbender. Best performance by an actor in a Brit independent film for
Hunger. That's right. Hunger, not The Hunger, because The Hunger is the Tony Scott movie. really.
He received this award at the 2008 British Independent Film Awards, which Simon no doubt followed avidly. In passing, the best actor last year was Viggo Mortensen, as the great Doctor will no doubt confirm.
Yes.
I am glad, says Fran Burnett, currently residing near Henley, who says, dear Wild Bill and Mr. Jingles, I'm very glad to see Mark Strong is finally getting the recognition he deserves. Not only is he a fantastic and versatile actor, but also is a phenomenal plumber. Whilst renting his flat in Hoxton Square, I watched him breaking George Clooney's fingers as he tinkered with our boiler. Lovely guy, cracking landlord. I also have a suggestion for a female actress to add to your hellos, me, a lowly jobbing actress who could benefit from the exposure to the countless cinematic luminaries who tune in every Friday. So hello to Fran Burnett.
Very good.
And hello to Mark Strong.
Hello to Mark Strong. Hello to Jason Isaacs.
Fairport Convention. The electric... Oh, you don't like the electric light?
No, I do like the electric light orchestra. No, let me get... Absolutely. I like the electric light. What I didn't like was the fact that you introduced it in a week that you were off with one of your other best friends. And then you said to me, oh, last week we did that. And then you went, oh, no, it wasn't you. It was the other bloke. Which is, you know, it's like when you... It is, isn't it? It's like going out and saying, you know, when we saw, oh no, it wasn't you, that was somebody else I was going out with. It was really hurtful.
Focus and Rick Wakeman and assorted members of Yes. Mark in Wheatley.
Charlotte from the Subways.
Having heard your mentions of Fairport and the Cropperty Festival, I wonder if anyone else has contacted you to pass on the bizarre connection with Ken Russell. Do you know the Ken Russell link?
No, I know Ken Russell, but I know
Ken Russell.
Go on.
You've filmed something and it's going out tonight. It's going back a few years now, I'd guess 1995, but I was at Cropperty when Ken Russell appeared on stage and directed the band, this is Fairport Convention, and crowd in a sequence he was filming to include in a documentary on musical traditions. Fairport mimed playing to a backing track, looking a bit confused, as indeed were we all. I'm not sure if it even got completed. Anyway, I hope you get the chance to attend Cropperty. A good time for Mark's band to play would be the Saturday tea time hooligan slot, as it's been christened over the years. Thanks, Mark. We'll pass that on. Well, maybe if that Saturday hooligan slot's available, we should...
I'll find out from Ken about that. Ken is in New York at the moment because he's directing a play off-Broadway. He's directing a play written by your mate, Anthony Horowitz.
Oh, he's doing that, is he?
He is, very yes. Good. It's happening even as we speak. He is off-Broadway directing a psychological thriller written by Anthony Horowitz, the author of Stormbreaker.
Which I have already seen because I think it was in the West End a few years ago.
Well, not directed by Ken, it wasn't.
No, but, you know...
No, but if it wasn't directed by Ken, then it wouldn't have
it
quite as many
Simon
people
Ward,
dressed as nurses
recall.
In, you know,
that's very true.
Rubber fetish wear.
Box office top 10. Tell us, just tease us of some fine reviews to come before
Madagascar
4.
2, Transporter 3.
Not with Jason.
It is. Although, actually, because Keith Allen did it better than I did, so I'm sort of slightly hesitant.
He had a great voice, didn't he?
But yeah.
And Secret Life of Bees, will that be coming up?
Yeah, we have. There's 14 movies out this week, so I'm going to have a run. Lakeview Terrace, we definitely need to do. Summer, I'd like to do. Madagascar, the thing called The Children, which is a British horror movie. So we'll see how many we get through. I'll aim for 5 or 6.
Have you ever booed in a film?
I heckled in Idiot in Cannes. But I wasn't booing, that was me shouting at it in French. I mean, very bad French, but I got so cross. And the thing that made me really cross was this ridiculous moment when the film descends into completely unwarranted hardcore pornography, and all these Cannes critics went, oh, bravo, so brave, oh, yes. And I stood up and started shouting at it in French, and I got thrown out. And actually, I wasn't back at Cannes for a few years after that. I was effectively thrown out of Cannes.
Simon Wood says, tell the good doctor to take one of his pills. The Nick Park Culture Show interview has already been seen. Tonight is the repeat. So we should feel free to talk about the great...
No, hang on. The point was, in the version that went out on Tuesday, we didn't give him the birthday cake because his birthday is tomorrow. And the version that goes out tonight is a longer version of the interview, which includes us wishing him a happy birthday and giving him his birthday. So I don't need to take a happy pill. I'm perfectly fine. Thank you very much.
I just want to read you this from Richard.
But well spotted.
Richard, who is known as Podcast Pom, is in Sydney. Baz Luhrmann's epic was mentioned...
Baz Luhrmann, yeah.
In our English language class today by three Italian girls. Apparently, it stars Nicole Kindling, he puts in brackets, thin and wooden, and huge action. Now, instantly I was there. That's it. She's Nicole Kindling. She's replaced IKEA. The students were raving about it. And from their description, let me tell you, it sounded like Titanic with kangaroos. Has Mark seen it, and is my description accurate? We haven't got to, you know, so tease us. Titanic with kangaroos, is that it?
No, but it was funny. I mean, there are things that one could take against it. I rather liked it, actually, but like all of Baz Luhrmann stuff, it's incredibly ambitious and it's hugely sprawling. And I went out there, I did a sort of an interview with him about it. But there was a review in the Australian press that said, you know, it features almost every Australian cliche, including didgeridoos, kangaroos, wallabies, and Rolf Harris. But, you know, no, I rather liked it.
And
Nicole Kindling and Hugh Jackman, yes.
Number 10 this week, Max Payne.
Well, it's on the way out now, isn't it? I think we've said enough.
Number 9 is Quarantine. Dear Five and Live says Piers. That's probably Stanger. MSc Physics, MSc Earth System Science. Mm. Dear Five and Live says, due to hateful conspiracy of timing, screening policies and the like, I found myself sitting through Quarantine this week. I could probably sum up the film as follows. Look out, someone's going to say boo in a minute. Boo.
That was a treat for streaming viewers as well, wasn't it? You telling me not to leap in.
Because you always do.
I know.
Zach and Miri thing at 8.
Rubbish.
What just happened? 7?
Yeah, well, the thing with What Just Happened is it's not a terrible film, but it isn't The Player. It's funny how it's essentially possible to make the same film as The Player all these years later, and yet it doesn't have the teeth that The Player did. I mean, The Player was a genuine insider's look at Hollywood, which featured, you know, stars cameoing as themselves. I mean, there's a fantastic cameo by Malcolm McDowell in The Player. You don't get any of that in What Just Happened. It's, you know, it's fun, but it's very, very flimsy and very light.
High School Musical 3, senior year, number 6, Toodles in Auckland.
Toodles.
This is Phil Henwood. Dear Troy and Gabriella, further to my email of 4 to 5 weeks ago, High School Musical 3 finally opened in Auckland yesterday.
Right.
And while you were all asleep, we went to see said film. Well, I have to say it was great. Good singing and acting. The most amazing thing was the choreography. Some of it was stunning. A really good kids family film. Although I didn't cry, I certainly had a lump in my throat during the graduation ceremony.
Oh, yeah, me too.
It got me thinking, this is a really good kids film starring kids. But what is the best adult film starring kids? I might really answer my own question with my submission, but I would go with Stand By Me. Never fails to move me, with some great acting from all the main leads and hardly any adults at all. What does the Good Doctor think? It's quite interesting. Best adult film starring kids.
You know, my heart would say The Midwich Cuckoos, Village of the Damned, because that is an adult film and it's horrible. Of course, you know, Exorcist stars a child, but
I think it's slightly more than a child.
There's a couple of versions of Lord of the Rings. The earliest version is not bad. That's definitely an adult movie. Time Bandits has got a child star, but it is an adult movie. Although, actually, Time Bandits, I suppose, is a kid's film, isn't it? I mean, it's upper-end kids. It's slightly dark, and they do get to meet the devil, played by David Warner.
When you say an upper-end kid, is it a teenager?
Yeah, no, I mean, yes, exactly, an upper-end
upper-end kids.
Yes. You know what I mean. No, but also, it's just because...
High School Musical 3's got a lot of upper-end kids in
it. But what he means, he doesn't mean with a child star, he means starring children. So in that case, I would say The Village of the Damned.
But Stand By Me kind of works.
No, Stand By Me is great, but I don't... I mean, what certificate was Stand By Me? Is it not a kid's film? I mean, it is. It's a coming-of-age story. Because the thing that everyone remembers about Stand By Me is that wraparound when the guy is writing his memoir, that at the end, he finishes writing his memoir and he closes the computer turns the computer off without pressing save.
Ah. My Best Friend's Girl at 5.
Oh, I did go and see it, and it was ghastly.
Body of Lies.
Dane, what's his name? He needs to be spoken to in very severe terms.
Body of Lies at 4.
You know, Ridley Scott, obviously in the groove in terms of churning them out one a year, but I don't think this is one of his better ones, although it does have a very good performance by Mark Strong, who I think, are we now including on the list?
Hello, absolutely.
Even if we don't know whether
he's
listening.
Simon in Exeter says, Dear Art and Garfunkel, enjoy the interview with Paul Bettany. Maybe you should include him on the Hello list. We should.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a big fan.
We'll do that.
But just in case he gets insecure, hello to Jason Isaacs.
It's Changeling at number 3.
Money on the table time, I think that she's going to win Best Actress at the Oscars. I really think that that's what's going to happen. Now, bear in mind that after 1 year in which I got a clean sweep of the top 5 categories, I've subsequently been completely wrong about almost everything since then. But I think Angelina Jolie is going to win Best Actress for Changeling.
Mike in Aylesbury, Dear Milliken and Nesbitt, last week a listener wrote to say how remiss it was of Clint Eastwood not to spot the spelling mistakes in a newspaper headline from his movie Changeling. This is an American spelling and not an error.
Yeah.
He concludes his email, great show, but spelt shoe.
Shoe.
Thanks. Chris in... where's this? I don't know. It's just
but it's Clues. It's C-L-E-W-S, isn't it? That was the spelling. I mean, that doesn't sound American. That just sounds wrong.
Chris Newcomb, BSc, who concludes, completely agree with a good doctor of Time and the City. Sublime wistful filmmaking. Oh, all those that say otherwise are attention deficit goldfish who should go back to watching their special editions of Transformers. Yep. Dear Dirty and Harry, went to see Changeling last week with my friend Anil at the Simply Gorgeous screen in the Curzon Mayfair. Over 2 hours later, we came out a little perplexed.
Yeah.
Whilst we both agreed that technically the film was stunning on every level, it lacked a certain narrative cohesion.
Well, no, I know.
Almost completely devoid of humour, grim set piece leading on to another grim set piece. You really feel the film's 2 hours and 20 minute running time. Individually, the parts are excellent, with a thriller part here, madhouse section there, and a courtroom drama that makes you want to become a lawyer. However, without the twin tent poles of Jolie's excellent performance and the fact that it's based on a real story holding it up, it would quickly become tedious.
I understand that criticism entirely, because when I first saw the film in Cannes, I didn't know it was based on a true story, and I thought almost exactly that. I thought, well, it's this kind of film and then it's that kind of film. And, you know, somebody, I think in one of their reviews, said it starts out as L.A. Confidential and ends up as Silence of the Lambs. It does feel oddly incoherent. But since the truth is so rigidly adhered to, one can only conclude that, you know, in a kind of Rabbi Lionel Blair kind of way, it's a bit like life. You know, that's...
What was that? That's a new voice.
No, well, that's Lard doing his impression of... You know, he used to do that character, the Reverend Lionel Blair, as opposed to Reverend Lionel Bloom. And he said, I thought, that's a bit like life. And it is, that in the end, life is not one genre, Simon. Life is forever.
Quantum of Solace at 2.
Question sport.
Four Christmases is the UK's number one.
Well, that's really reason to just give up hope now, isn't it? You know... I mean, everyone keeps talking about the credit crunch and there's no money. Well, people are spending their money going to see Four Christmases. If they can't look after it better than that...
It's like the kid in Outnumbered. I don't know if you're watching that on Saturday night, who says,
no.
If we're so tight on money, can we just save money by not buying any broccoli? So if we're so tight on money, just don't go and see Four Christmases.
Yeah, no, exactly, really. Because, I mean, all it is you're just watching the savings plan for Vince Vaughn and Reese Witherspoon to have a nice Christmas.
So what do you want to go with first?
Well, let's start with Lakeview Terrace, because I think that's a good one to start with.
Is it?
Yes,
well,
it
I
is.
Think we'll be the judge.
But are we
going
to do it now? It's 2 minutes to half past.
Yes.
I can't do it in 2 minutes.
How
I'll
long
do something
do
else. Well, can I do something else in the 2 minutes?
How long? Well, I don't know. What do you want to do?
Because I'll do something without a clip, because I can't do a clip with too many. You're wasting time. Let me tell you about the children.
I'm not wasting any time. You are asking me questions.
Let me tell you about the children. Right, the children is the second feature by Tom Shanklin, who made the film that you described as that torture film. Remember that was W
oh, yeah.
thingy Z, right? Which was I didn't like at all.
I didn't like it.
Very tough and very grim.
That's because there was torture in it.
No, there was a lot of other reasons why it was tough and grim. But the fact that you just referred to it as the torture film. But anyway, so this is
Stefan Skarsgård.
Stellan Skarsgård. Stefan Elliott, who's, you know, an Australian director who directed Priscilla Queen of the Desert, as opposed to Stellan Skarsgård, who is, you know,
very famous,
a European act. Fine. Anyway, so the story is two families... It's a horror film. It's a paedophobic horror film. Two families go on holiday to this cottage, which is, you know, remote, which is never a good idea. The kids all seem to sort of know each other and get on, yet there's lots of sort of underlying tensions, and then weird stuff starts to happen. It looks like maybe there's some kind of bacterial outbreak. The children start to behave strangely. Maybe there's a demonic possession thing going on. There's ominous signs in the sky, and then things turn very nasty. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. There's a very strong thread of, you know, paedophobic, as in fear of children, is a common thing in horror, and it runs right back to, I suppose you could look at The Turn of the Screw, and if you look in movies, then you'd look at things like, you know, The Omen, obviously The Exorcist to some extent, Village of the Damned, Midwich Cuckoos. This reminded me of a very tacky paperback that was around in the 1970s, 1980s called Let's Go Play at the Addams. This idea of children not being, you know, innocent, being quite scary. The tagline, at least one of the taglines for the children, was, you brought them into this world, they're going to take you out of it, which I think whoever came up with that really deserves.
That needs to be said in a scary voice, then.
But the interesting thing about it is, I actually thought it was a very convincingly chilling and nasty experience watching the film. And I thought watching it, God, this is really grim. Actually, when you look at the BBFC report, they've given it a 15 certificate, and they say that although, you know, it does have a few scenes in it that are strongly violent, it says here, the violence is aggravated somewhat by the fact that it is doled out by and to young children, but it was felt that the clearly fantastical story and familiar conventions of the horror genre served as sufficient mitigation for the work to be passed at 15. Well, that's very interesting, because I didn't think it was particularly generic. I thought actually one of the things that was really creepy about it was that they kept its feet very firmly on the ground. I mean, It's a fairly small and, you know, confined production, and it's a very simple idea. There's a group of children. The children turn nasty. Really bad stuff happens, and it's working with a, you know, an old idea. But I thought it was rather well done, certainly much better than I'd expected from the director of Woz. And it's genuinely nasty. Genuinely nasty.
What does that mean?
It means I thought, I'm uncomfortable about this. And that's really what horror films are supposed to do. I'm not saying it's flawless, and I'm not saying that, you know, it's not, but it was atmospheric. It was, you think you've seen more than you actually have seen. And it did do that thing which horror is meant to do, which is to get under your skin and make you feel really uncomfortable, as opposed to what an awful lot of those things do, which is just make you go, yeah, I've seen this before, and here's the list of things that they refer to.
Are we building up to Lakeview Terrace in a moment?
Yeah, but I did that in 2.5 minutes without a clip, so round of applause, thank you.
No,
I didn't mean literally round of applause. Anyway, that was the very dictionary definition of a smattering of applause.
It's the most unenthusiastic applause. However, it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, I think so.
Best adult film starring kids. This from Richard Wilson. Hmm. Has to be BMX Bandits. Genius. Also stars Nicole Kindling.
Yeah, that's right. Nicole Kindling with sort of curly ginger hair before she became straight blonde.
Dear friend Ginger says Martin Terz, BA Honours, CAS, which, if I remember rightly, is Comparative American Studies. He says, I would go for Son of Rambo. Saw it recently in my student cinema at Warwick, and although starring kids, I thought it was great looking at how people can feel trapped within the lives that they live.
No, I agree, and that's one of my favourite films of the year. Terrific movie.
And various other suggestions. We've got Angels with Dirty Faces, Lord of the Rings, Kes, Whistle Down
Lord
the Wind.
Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
Or Lord Star of the Kids?
Well, maybe he means Lord
of the Flies. That's a big difference. Lord of the Rings, you know, elves and goblins, Lord of the Flies.
Just before we get into this, Martin, BDS, VU, Mank 1990, he also adds cycling proficiency badge, 50-meter breaststroke certificate, Swiss Ski School Silver Award, and highly commended in the South Sea Show Lemon Meringue Pie Contest 1995, but I have lost the certificate for that one. Dear Knight and Lee, looking at the films on release this week, they number about 13, which is silly when you think about it. Even The Good Doctor wound up to full clatter. Would struggle to talk about them all in an hour. So which ones will be discussed? A big cartoon, bit of Samuel L. Jackson, a rant-worthy Jason Statham vehicle, something arty with Sigourney Weaver, a few others, and some token documentary about Patti Smith, which will probably get one showing at the Corner House before Singing Forever.
At Corner House.
Inevitably, given the presence of two music anorak blokes of a certain age, we're going to get half an hour of tedious wittering and noodling about Patti Blummin' Smith, exactly as per Neil Young a while back. But you don't discuss why she did her best work when she was going out with Blue Oyster Cult's keyboard player Alan Lenier, and ever since has been insufferably dull.
Yeah, no, we're not going to do that.
Okay, what's out this week?
Let's do Lakeview Terrace.
Oh, it's Lakeview Terrace.
Which is a new film by Neil LaBute, who's had a very interesting and sort of strange career. He's a controversial director. He's been called various times, you know, a misogynist and a misanthrope. And
that doesn't leave anyone else, really, does it?
Well, racist, more recently, as a result of Lakeview Terrace. Because he made things like Company of Men, Your Friends and Neighbours, which were kind of edgy and strange. Then he did Nurse Betty, which I liked very much. And what's that incredibly strange noise?
I think it's one of the cameras moving around to zoom in.
Oh, very bizarre. And the most recent thing he did was he remade The Wicker Man, which was a terribly bad idea. And he remade The Wicker Man as a kind of strange feminist or anti-feminist parable. It's hard to tell. Essentially, having gone from being a cult, in the thrall of Christopher Lee in the original, it became a cult of women into whose territory goes Nicolas Cage, but he is overwhelmed by their womanhood, and then in the end they put him in a wicker man and set fire to him, like in the original one, only not interesting. So now he's back on form with this peculiar thing, and Lakeview Terrace is essentially one of those cases in which it's a B-movie. It's a sort of straight-to-video thriller that just happens to have A-list credentials, very much like, do you remember when Training Day, because Training Day ended up being an Oscar-winning movie, but it was clearly a B-movie, you know, made-for-television thing, but it was made really well. And so, similar idea here. A young couple, he's white but interested in rap, she's black but interested in being, you know, very kind of well-to-do middle class and setting up a family, move into the eponymous neighbourhood, eponymous meaning
Lakeview Terrace.
Thank you.
No, of the title.
Of the title. And their next-door neighbour is Sam Jackson, who's a policeman. And you think you'd be safe living next door to Sam Jackson as your next door. But of course, as is the way with these things, Sam Jackson takes against them because he doesn't think they're the right kind of people in the neighbourhood. So there's all this sort of weird racial tension going on, which is to do with they've got a mixed marriage.
So he disapproves of the mixed marriage.
It's implied that he might do, but he generally disapproves of them in total. And he's patrolling the neighborhood and trying to keep the neighborhood together. And gradually, relationships between them get worse and worse. The thing you need to have in your mind as you're listening to this clip is, did you ever see unlawful entry?
That's what I have to bear in mind.
Okay.
It's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, you know, but I was wondering whether you had seen... That wasn't the question. Have you ever seen unlawful entry?
I don't think so.
Fine. Okay, in that case, you won't get any sense of deja vu with this at all.
Oh, great.
Here's a clip.
Abel, hold on. Look.
And whatever it is about me or us that bothers you, we got to figure out a way to deal with this, all right?
So what do you propose?
What?
What's your agenda?
Can't we all just get along?
Oh, not Rodney King. You playing the race card?
Come on, man. This is getting a little out of hand. I need you to back off.
Back off?
Yeah, a little.
Or what?
See, you keep saying stuff like that. Like, we're not welcome here, we should move. But we're fitting in just fine.
Says who?
Stay out of my life.
Stay out.
So everyone who's seen Unlawful Entry is now thinking what?
Well, no, basically, it's a very, very similar idea that they move into a house and the next and you know, the neighbours are cops, but of course the cop turns out to be sort of slightly psychotic. But what happens in this whole thing is spiced up by this actually rather well-done, complicated racial politics. Now, some people have taken it upon themselves to say that the racial politics of the film are racist. Then they're not. It's a clearly stupid thing to say. I mean, for a start, Sam Jackson is unlikely to be involved in because he's a very, very astute, intelligent man who takes a very firm line on these things. But what it does is... It's very interesting because it plays everyone against the wrong stereotype. There's one marvellous moment when the main guy is sitting in his car and Sam Jackson knocks on the window and he's scared because he thinks he's being mugged. Then it turns out that actually it's Sam Jackson who is the cop. And Sam Jackson then says to him, because he's listening to rap music, and he says, why are you listening to rap music in the car? He says, well, my wife doesn't like this. She hates rap music. And Sam Jackson says to him, you can listen to that noise all you like, but when you wake up in the morning, you're still going to be white. And there's this whole sort of, you know, kind of strange inverted stuff going on in the inverted racist stuff going on in the dialogue. Now, inevitably with these things, there's a moment when it has to just go bonkers. And the moment comes quite late on in the film. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, hold on to it, because you know that's the way these things work out. You get the kind of the broiling tension. If you look at any of these sort of urban horror films, something like Pacific Heights or any of them, it's how long can they keep this sort of, you know, everything under control before it has to descend into silliness? Well, in the end, it descends into silliness with, you know, forest fires and helicopters and shootouts and nonsense and all that kind of thing. But there's a really good hour and a quarter of it in which it manages to keep a hold on itself. And I think a couple of things about it. I think it's a smartly written script. I think LeBute directs with confidence and he demonstrates that he can do really good nuts and bolts putting stuff together. And Sam Jackson is just great. And there is something about Sam Jackson that he does have when he's on fire. He has a real presence. You think about him doing all those speeches in Pulp Fiction, for example, when he was doing, you know, he's reciting the great long swathes of Tarantino dialogue. And you realize that what's impressing you isn't the dialogue. It's the fact that it's Sam Jackson delivering it. He's a very, very charismatic person. I know that you're sort of looking a bit glum because you and I met him once very briefly in Hollywood. And do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The Star Wars thing. And he was the very quintessence of not charismatic. But on screen...
I tell you, because... Of all the things in the world, he didn't want to talk to us.
That's exactly right.
Fair enough.
Yeah, but he's very charismatic presence. He's used very well in this. I mean, as I said, it is essentially a straight-to-video B-movie that just happens to have A-list talent in front of and behind the camera. But for a good two-thirds of its running time, I really enjoyed it. And when it went nuts at the end, I kind of thought it had earned the right to go a bit bonkers, and then it did the explosion. So I mean, I'd still love to see one of those movies in which it didn't go nuts in the end and was still a big box office hit.
Ian Fox in Milwaukee, but originally from Leeds. Dear Agneta and Anifrid...
I think
I'll be Agneta. Given that we're going to be getting a Transporter 3 review, will that be next?
Jason Statham.
I wanted to mention I recently saw a showing on TV here in the US of a Jason Statham classic, In the Name of the King, a dungeon siege tale. Without doubt, the worst movie I have ever seen. Yes, worse than Battlefield Earth. Jason Statham as a boomerang-wielding turnip farmer and Burt Reynolds in full battle armour. Fantastic. Maybe the good doctor could let us know how Uwe Boll keeps finding work.
Oh, well, you know, is that an Uwe Boll film? You know who Uwe Boll is?
He's the director of In the Name of the King of Dungeons.
Generally regarded as being the worst filmmaker in the world. And he was a guy who, he organised this thing, which was, he was so fed up with people telling him that he was the worst filmmaker in the world. He had a thing in which he said, fine, come and fight me. And he invited critics from around the world to go and fight him. And then some did, apparently.
I think that's great.
Yeah. I mean,
it would get to you after a while, wouldn't it? If everybody thinks you're the worst in the world at what you do.
I just say, incidentally, the phrase a boomerang-wielding turnip farmer does sound like a euphemism for something, but I can't quite think what.
850-58, I'm sure you'll suggest it. Bobby in Surbiton, dear Santa and Rudolph, listening live for the first time, being an avid podcaster, I wish to point out how strange it is that the travel report doesn't just fade out to silence after a few seconds. How refreshing, says Bobby in Surbiton. Okay, so it's Jason Statham time. And
Jason Statham.
Yeah. Who usually plays exactly the same character, but I'm sure in Transporter 3 it's all changed.
Yeah, it's all changed. In Transporter 3, Jason Statham plays a man who wears a suit, drives a car, hits people, and takes the suit off. He doesn't want to do this job, but he hasn't got any choice. Do you want to hear a clip?
As long as the voice is as good as yours.
It is.
I took the liberty of bringing your suit. It's what you wear when you're working, correct?
Correct. But I'm not working.
You see, boss, I told you.
Please, Joseph. Your approach is not very effective in presenting our proposal the first time. Thank you.
As I was saying, we came to you in good faith. You said you were unavailable. We contracted with the man whose number you gave us. He proved to be ineffective. And now I am left with unfinished business. The way I see it, you're responsible.
I understand your point of view. But I'm still unavailable.
Boss, can I say something?
Anyone else want to say something? You have 3 seconds to change your mind, or you're going to be permanently unavailable.
One condition.
I'm listening.
I drive my own car.
And he does.
He does he?
He does drive his own car. Now, there's a plot, okay? There is a plot which is to do with eco-friendly flibbity-gibbity stuff and some Russian woman who's got to be taken from place A to place B who, in theory, turns into some area of love interest. Frankly, who cares? None of that's relevant. Here's all you need to know. Jason puts the suit on. He gets in the car. He drives the car very fast. He gets into a scrap with some people. And when the going gets tough, he takes his shirt off to fight them. Now, there's one particularly brilliant scene when the Russian girl, who nobody cares about, not the camera, not the script, not the nothing, nobody, right? Jason's out, he's surrounded by a group of blokes, right? Butch blokes. And he has to fight them. So obviously he has to take off the suit. And they've actually brought, I mean, they keep making jokes about the suit. It's not like they don't know. So he takes off the suit and he fights the guys with the suit as he's taking it off. He strangles them with his shirt, then he flicks them with his thing, right? And he does this. So he's stripped to the waist because it's a weapons thing. He has to be stripped to the waist in the same way that in the Transporter 1, right? He had to be stripped to the waist and covered in oil in order to wrestle with the guys because it was a plot point. And then, as if that wasn't enough, a little bit later on, the Russian woman, who up until this point has done absolutely nothing,
we don't care about,
and no, but anyway, and it turns out she's not Russian, she's Ukrainian apparently, and I don't, so she says to Jason Statham, I want you to strip for me. And Jason says, you what? She says, I want you to strip for me. No, I don't think I'm going to do that. But then he does. And then there's a scene, right? It's fantastic, in which Jason Statham takes off his shirt, takes off it for the benefit of the Russian, while a camera that's on a helicopter circles around in kind of Valkyrie-like, you know, huge transport of delight. And here's the thing that I really like about Jason Statham. For a start, he seems to be a solid enough bloke. I mean, anyone who could survive being in that Guy Ritchie film, that, you know, revolver thing, in which he's in it, in which he actually is a scene in it which he has to have an argument with himself in a lift. And it's one of the worst scenes ever filmed. Madonna said it was one of the greatest scenes ever filmed in cinema ever, but that was before she divorced him. He came out of that. He came out of it unscathed. Now, in this, he knows what he did. He knows he looks great in a suit. He knows he looks great behind the wheel of a black car. And he knows he looks great with stripped to the waist doing that thing. And they're smart enough to understand that that's what the target audience want. And they give it to them. Now, you know what? There's B-movies that pretend to be something else. And there's B-movies that know what they are. And this is a B-movie that knows what it is. And I grinned all the way through it. And during the Jason Statham stripping sequence, I felt like standing up and going, Your Honour, ka-ching. Thank you very much. Exactly. I refer you to my previous argument about the oil wrestling thing. There should be no more debate. This is exactly what this is for. It's, you know, a fantastic homoerotic spectacle in the mould of Women in Love and in the mould of Eastern Promises. No, fine. And you know what's great about it? It's an exploitation movie. They do it, and they do it properly.
Ed in Ipswich says, "Dear Freebie and the Bean, being a big fan of Transporter 1, a bit less of a fan of the sequel, I was interested
in... Yeah, 3 is much better than 2.
I was interested in reading that the director of Transport 2...
Louis Leterrier. You said Transport 2.
Transport 2.
Transport.
It's just a way of getting through it quicker.
Yeah. Louis Leterrier then went on to direct something else.
Envisage Frank Martin as gay. In fact, he thinks that the second movie is much more fun if you have that in the back of your mind. I understand they removed that idea by the time they were filming it. Given that there is a big slice of homoeroticism in the movies anyway, does the good doctor think that the popularity of the Transporter franchise would have been effective if Statham had been outed in Transporter 2?
Well, in Transporter 3, there's a fantastic moment when the Russian woman that nobody cares about, she says, you know, I want you and me to, she's gone French, I can't do Russian, so she's going to be French. She says, I want you and me to, you know, and he says, I'm not interested. And she says, oh, are you the gay? He says, no, I'm not the gay. But he says it in that way, I am not the gay, all right?
You love him. Do you love him more than Paul Bettany?
No.
You love Paul more than... Because he takes his shirt off then, doesn't he?
Yeah, I know, but it's a wonderful moment. It's a wonderful moment, and I'd love to be on set did that.
It might be movie of the week, you never know. What else is new?
Well, do you want to quickly do Secret Life of Bees, since you kept mentioning it? I mean, do you want me to say anything? Or can I do Madagascar 2?
Let's do both before 4.
Well, let's very quickly say a couple of things about Secret Life of Bees. We've covered it in some depth on this programme already. I mean, I think that, you know, you read out that review by Roger Ebert saying that his tear ducts effectively overrode
He said that kind of overrode all the film, the weight of film criticism.
Yeah. There is an argument, I think, that any film that provokes a physical response in critics tend to not like. I mean, whether it's laughter or whether it's crying or whether it's, you know, arousal, any of those things, you know, they think, well, that's bad. But, you know, intellectual movies are good. Now, you couldn't in any way argue that Secret Life of Bees is a great...
That makes critics just sound stupid, though.
There are some people who do say that. There are many people who say that. I think
that's why we all go to the films, isn't it? To be moved, to be excited, to be thrilled.
Well, I think so.
Scared.
Yes, I think so, and I think
upset.
I think proper criticism does take account of the response that that a film causes in you, even if you think it's not academically or intellectually challenging. I think the thing with Secret Life of Bees is it's not a great movie. It is very baggy, and its politics are very solidly liberal, but not in a kind of particularly striking or daring way. But it's warmly enough put together. It looks like it was made by people who, you know, cared about the subject matter. Paul Bettany is very good in it. Queen Latifah is actually not bad in it. And it's a sort of coming-of-age story with a you know, we are the world, you know, hey, why can't we all get along message. And it's passing fair, but no better than that. But it is true that it does seem to have a warm heart. I have to say, I didn't fall for it particularly, but I did think that its intentions were at least on the right side of honourable.
John in South London. Dear Proper Doctor and Improper Doctor, my wife reports that Messrs Ritchie, Downey Jr. and Law have been sniffing around her workplace this week in preparation for the filming of that Sherlock Holmes movie, and
Sherlock
I'm wondering
Holmes.
How I can put this information to good use. I'm keen to do my bit to defend the cause of cinematic integrity and good taste, but have already discarded such plans as gluing Guy Ritchie's trailer door shut as being too petty, hiring a Madonna impersonator to heckle him as being too expensive. Apart from the obvious, not seeing the film, is there anything else that your loyal listeners can do to stop this travesty from happening? Awaiting your instructions. Well, this will have to be done over the next week, I think.
Can I say something? That there is always the possibility that even the worst filmmaker in the world can make a good film. And I think you have to always live with that possibility. Now, I don't think that I've seen in Guy Ritchie's CV evidence that he can put tab A into slot B at all.
Is he worse than... Uwe Boll?
Well, no, Uwe Boll's got a higher hit rate. He turns the movies out faster and they're shorter. And you know, at least Uwe Boll, he's an exploitation filmmaker, so I've got more respect for him anyway. But it's always possible that after all these years, somebody will prove us wrong. You know, you just never know. You absolutely never know. John Borman's working on a new film. Apparently John Borman is working on an animated version of Wizard of Oz. I mean, you know, it sounds ghastly, but you never know. It's always possible. So I think the best thing you can do is with an open mind, Let him do whatever, you know, and then go in and judge it.
So don't hire the Madonna impersonator. Don't glue his door. Let's see what happens.
No, exactly. Okay. I mean, this is not just to do with goodwill to all men because it's Christmas. I genuinely think that people whose work I've hated in the past have suddenly turned around and made something brilliant.
Tell us about Madagascar.
Well, very quickly, you saw Madagascar, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, you remember the animals are in the zoo.
Yeah, yeah.
They escape. They think they're going to Africa. They end up in Madagascar, right? And they have an adventure in Madagascar. And then now, this one starts, they're in Madagascar. There's a weird thing at the beginning in which they basically go back to the birth of the key character, and then they take him forward, and then they get some flashback sequence that doesn't work at all. Anyway, they rebuild the plane, and they get on the plane to fly back to New York, and this time they crash in Africa. You see?
Who would have thought it?
Who would have thought it? And then they crash in Africa, and then there's a whole kind of Lion King scenario. Plays out. Now, the plot, all over the place, because basically it's the collection of characters. And I should say two things. Firstly is, I didn't much care for Madagascar, but then, you know, I've seen kids really, really love it. I've seen kids watch it on video again and again and again and again and again, so clearly I missed something. But the one thing I did say about the first one was that the show was completely stolen by Sacha Baron Cohen. He's back in the second one, does the same thing again. Here's a clip of Sacha Baron Cohen attempting to cheer up David Horseface Schwimmer, as a depressed giraffe.
There is this one thing.
What is it? Tell me.
No, I couldn't. I mean,
what is it?
You know, I just never really had the guts to tell Gloria how
what
I
is
feel
it?
About her. How I
please tell
I never
me.
Really had the guts to tell Gloria how I feel about her. How I've always felt about her.
Fine, don't tell me. Oh!
Is it a woman?
Oh, you didn't tell me. We're talking about a woman.
What are you afraid of? You're a dead man anyway. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
Well, you're gonna march right up to this woman.
Right?
You look her right in the eye. You lean forward, right? Just a little, almost all the way. Then you let her, like, lean forward just another little bit until you're just a lip's distance away from each other. And then you just tell her how much you hate her.
Actually, it's more like love her.
Oh, you sly dog! Woof, woof! You are a real player, you know that?
There we go, you laughed.
Oh, that was good.
Well, that's it. If you like that bit happens a few times. That's really all there is to say about it. They get to do the move it, move it, move it, the singy, dancey thing. And the animation is exactly the same as the animation.
Song.
Yes, singy. Right. No, but it's not singy, dancey, isn't it? Because they're singing and dancing.
Okay, yeah.
Like walkie-talkie, singy, dancey. There's no expansion from the original film. I can't say it's any structurally better than the original film. It's a collection of bits. It's a collection of comedy actors doing some comedy bits, and some of the comedy bits are funnier than the other comedy bits, and the comedy bits with Sacha Baron Cohen are funnier than the comedy bits with David Schwimmer, and some of the comedy bits with Ben Stiller in are a little bit funnier than the bits, well, everything's funnier than the bits with David Schwimmer, and then whenever Sacha Baron Cohen's on, I'm laughing, and then when the other stuff is on, it's passing fair, and I know that I'll see it a million times on DVD when it comes out, and it's available in an IMAX print, and it's completely kid-friendly, and it's not going to offend or hurt or upset anybody, but nor is it going to inspire much.
So, all things considered, then, we didn't get to
I was going to say summer, you see. Summer's my film of the week, and I haven't even had a chance to do it.
You can't. You're doing this all the time. 30 seconds from the end, you get to your movie. That's just...
Well, I'll tell you what will happen.
Summer
will be in the top 10 next week, so let me, in that case...
Well, choose a movie of the week that at least you've mentioned...
Well, Lakeview Terrace, but I'd like to fly the flag for Transporter 3.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.